Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
We've got good news. The world is open again, and people like you, people of faith, are traveling to Catholic sites around the world. Want to travel with exceptional Catholic leaders this fall, next year, or in the future? Are you looking to see specific sites, celebrate traditional Latin Mass, or travel to destinations without vaccine requirements? We are here to help you deepen your faith on pilgrimage. Give us a call at 1-800-842-4842 or visit us online at selectinternationaltours.com. Select International Tours is your pilgrimage company, and we have the perfect Catholic trip for you.
Are you looking to serve God and society? Consider putting your gifts to work as a lawyer. Ave Maria School of Law has been educating faith-filled lawyers for over 20 years. Ave Maria School of Law is committed to training lawyers to use law appropriately around the moral issues of our time. Visit avemarialaw.edu to learn more about integrating your faith with a law degree.
Welcome back, Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, and as promised, Jimmy Akin here with us for the second hour, and it's all open forum. Anybody can call with any question at all. 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, of course, is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of a whole bunch of things, books and blog posts and ebooks and all kinds of stuff, including The Bible is a Catholic Book and A Daily Defense, 365 Days Plus One to Becoming a Better Apologist. Senior apologist Jimmy Akin, thanks for being with us.
Host of Catholic Answers Live, Cyril Kellett. It's my pleasure.
I wonder if we're ever going to stop doing that. I don't know. I find that funny.
We don't do it all the time. It would get old then.
But I guess it would.
Once in a while.
It's funny. I don't think it would get old to me.
Not the substance.
I guess so. Let me close my computer here. 888-318-7884, the number. Let me tell you how many lines are open. Well, I'll just say this. Good luck. Hope you call 888-318-7884. Tomorrow, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World will drop. Thousands and thousands of people look forward to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World each week. What drops tomorrow?
About 70,000 people at least listen to it every week. It's consistently in the top 25 documentary podcasts in the U.S. on Apple Podcasts. But tomorrow is part two of our look at the 9/11 attacks, and going to be looking specifically. So last time we looked at how the damage was done. Was it just planes? Was it something other than planes? You know, what was involved in doing the damage? This time we're looking at who was responsible. So we're going to be looking into the 9/11 conspiracy itself. And yes, it was a conspiracy.
Oh, yeah.
By definition, a conspiracy is an agreement between two or more people to do something illegal. And killing thousands of innocent people is illegal. And this took more than one person to execute. So by definition, there was a conspiracy or an agreement among somebody to carry out the 9/11 attacks. And we're going to be looking at what the evidence says about who was involved, including whether it could have been an inside job.
Oh, so and you can get that at Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and you can get to Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World by just typing in those words, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, and you'll come to it. I think 70,000 is fantastic, and 70,000 and growing.
Yeah, indeed. We have an upward trend in the listenership. People like sharing it with their friends and family, and so there's some regular growth happening.
Good work, Jimmy Akin. You ready to answer some questions?
Sure.
Because every single line filled up in about a minute. Michael in Ohio listening on Annunciation Radio. You are first up with Jimmy today. Michael, go ahead with your question.
Thank you for taking my call. Our pastor has invited catechists from the neo-catechumenate way.
Oh, a neo-catechumenal way, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. To give... sessions at our parish, I think with the intent of forming the groups at the end. But many people is kind of grumbling about it, and people are saying it's a cult. And I was wondering if Jimmy could respond or how should one respond to somebody who says, I can't believe what the Father's doing, it's a cult.
Okay.
And then also, okay, is there anything written from Catholic Answers that would be good to read about it?
Well, to take the last question first, because, of course, the last shall be first and the first shall be last. I don't know if we have anything that Catholic Answers has written about it. If we do, it'll be on Catholic.com. Something to watch out for, though, is the status of the neo-catechumenal way has changed over the years. And so even if you do find something at Catholic.com, it may not be current. It may be something that was written some years ago when they had a different status. In terms of, is it a cult? Well, it's going to depend on what you mean. The term cult has more than one meaning. And one of the ways the term cult is used is a neutral way. When the term cult is used in a neutral sense, it refers to any devotion. And so since the neo-catechumenal way is a devotional system, you know, it's a particular form of spirituality, it would be a cult in that sense, but so would saying the rosary, having Marian spirituality, having charismatic spirituality, having Dominican spirituality, having Tridentine traditional Latin Mass spirituality. All of those are different forms of spirituality. And in the neutral sense, all of those are cults. So that's not really a particularly informative way of using the term because it applies to basically any kind of devotion. It sounds like, though, that the people you're talking to are not using it in a neutral sense, though. They're using it in a negative sense. And this is the most common use. The negative sense of the term cult is the most common way the term is used in contemporary English. If people say something's a cult, they mean it's a bad religious group or a religious group they don't like. The problem is that's all the term means. There is no objective definition for the term cult in standard English. There are no set of characteristics can be applied to define exactly what a cult is. And so the term ends up just being an insult word. It's just an insult word that's applied to groups that people don't like and that they think are bad. And as a result, it's also not a very informative use of the term. All it tells us is the person making the accusation that someone is a cult doesn't like that group, but it doesn't tell us anything about them. And as a result, it sheds more heat than light. It gets discussion started of, is this a cult or not? And people get all riled up in this debate, but there's no real way of settling it one way or the other because the term is so subjective. And so I personally don't use the word cult in that way. And I recommend that other people not use the term cult in that way because it's just an insult. It doesn't really mean anything. If we step back and look at, I think what's better than calling someone a cult is naming the things you don't like, because then you have some room for discussion. If you say, I think this group is bad because of this, or I don't like the group because of this, well, then you can discuss the merits of whatever it is you've named. You know, is that really the case? Is that really bad? Is that really, is it not so bad? You can discuss that and because you've got an actual issue on the table rather than just using an insult word. In terms of the neo-catechumenal way, it has a history that goes back a while. It's one of the new religious movements that started in the Catholic Church in the last few decades. And there are grounds for criticism that have been raised. In fact, the Holy See itself had criticisms of the way the neo-catechumenal way was being run. The founder of the neo-catechumenal way had produced this large volume of catechetical literature, part of why they're called neo-catechumenal. They had this catechetical literature, and the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith said, hey, some of this stuff needs to be clarified. It is not all expressing the Catholic faith the way it needs to. Also, the neo-catechumenal way set up its own style of liturgy without approval from the Holy See, and so the Congregation for the Congregation for Divine Worship and the Discipline of the Sacraments got involved and said, hey, you need to do your liturgy within what the church's liturgical law allows. And so they developed a set of criteria. They said, look, here are some things you can't do, can do. Here are some things you can't do. The Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, meanwhile, reviewed their catechetical literature and said, here are the corrections you need to make. And they ultimately agreed to do all those things. And so today, the neocatechumenal way is approved by the Vatican. And if the Vatican approves something, I'm not going to say it can't or shouldn't be in a parish, because it's been reviewed and it's been given a seal of approval by the Holy See itself. So it might or might not be to a given person's taste. They may or may not find that neocatechumenal spirituality helps them. So it's up to them whether they want to be involved in it or not. But I wouldn't accuse them of being somehow illegitimate when the Vatican itself has approved them. What I would say is that human beings are human beings, and so they can make mistakes. And given that there has been a history of some doctrinal confusion with the neocatechumenal way and of liturgical practices that shouldn't be done, I would say it's certainly sound to say, well, we want to keep an eye on this. You know, we want to make sure that if it's happening in our parish, that it's happening in a way that's consistent with what the church has mandated for the neocatechumenal way, that they're not falling back into bad habits and they're not being doctrinally confused and they're not doing liturgical things that they shouldn't. But as long as they're complying with what the Vatican said they needed to do, then I would say it's legitimate for them to be active in a parish just like any other devotional group.
And Michael, we'll leave it there because we've got to take a break. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's open forum, 888-318-7884.
Call and ask Jimmy your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live is underwritten with support from Homeschool Connections. Teens and parents, Homeschool Connections invites you to the Life After High School online conference, October 7th to 8th, with information on Catholic universities, trade schools, and religious vocations, plus workshops. CatholicHomeschoolConference.com.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
The people who call More to Life are often hurting so much. I just want to reach through the radio and hug them. I want them to know how loved they are and how much God wants to fill their hearts with His healing grace and His deep desire to completely transform the life of anyone who's open to the movement of His Holy Spirit.
More to Life with Dr. Greg and Lisa Popchak. Tomorrow morning, 10 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Killett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and I'm feeling better because I've been worried about Sarah, who called yesterday at the end of the show, and we couldn't take her call because I kind of messed up the clock on Sarah, and now Sarah did just what I asked her to do. She called back. Sarah, are you there with us?
Yes.
Thank you very much for calling us back. I appreciate you waiting. Okay. Are you ready with your question for Mr. Akin?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Go ahead with your question.
Why can't girls be priests?
Okay. In the ancient world, there actually were women who were priests. There were priestesses in many different religions in the ancient world. But Jesus, in setting up his church, chose not to have any women be Christian priests. He only chose the apostles to be his initial priests, and they were all men. It has nothing to do with who's the best person because his mom, Mary, is the best person. You know, she's sinless. She's perfect as a human being. And so he didn't pick people to be priests based on how good they were. And so women can be just as good as men. They can be just as holy as men. But Jesus, for one reason or another, chose to only pick males, men, to be priests. And we can speculate on why that is. We can try to figure out why he might have done that. But the fact is, that is what he did. And so the church has always understood that it needs to honor Jesus' decision, that the church doesn't have the ability to just do its own thing and go contrary to what Jesus did. In terms of why he might have done this, people have thought about it, and one of the ideas they've suggested is that it has to do with the differences between men and women in terms of giving life. Women are able to do something that no man can do. They can be mother, give life to their children in a way that men simply cannot do. Priests, however, are spiritual fathers. They give spiritual life. And so some people have suggested that maybe the reason Jesus chose to have men as his priests is because it kind of balances things. Women get to be spiritual mothers. I'm sorry, women get to be physical mothers, which is something no man can do. And so men get to be spiritual fathers, and it kind of balances things. And that's been one of the ideas that people have proposed. Maybe that's why Jesus made this choice. But regardless of why he made the choice, the church has said we need to accept Jesus's choice and we need to honor it.
Okay, Sarah? Do we still have Sarah there with us? Hang on. Maybe Sarah, I'm sorry. That was us. We couldn't hear you. Is that answer okay for you, Sarah?
Yeah.
Okay, good. You know what, Sarah? You were so nice and you called back a second day, and I would like to send you a book. We have a graphic novel called The Truth Is Out There, and a lot of people really like this. It's got great pictures in it. If you would like it, you got to ask, is your mom or dad there with you?
No.
Oh, is there an adult there with you?
No.
Oh, okay. Sarah, I'll tell you what. I want to send you that book, but I can't have Sarah give us her address if there's no adult there. All right. I'm going to let you talk with Thomas, and Thomas is going to figure out a way that we can get a book to you. Maybe we can send it to your parish. Hang on. Thomas, would you please help Sarah? Thank you very, very much. Our number is 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. That was nice that Sarah called back again. Let's go to Chris in Miami listening on TuneIn Radio. Chris, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Oh, man. Jimmy Akin, Cy Kellett, you guys are awesome. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
And my family and I are also part of this 70,000-plus listeners of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. So awesome.
You are a very wise man.
Thank you. My question is this. Yeah. My question is this. I know how in the Old Testament we see instruction given to the priesthood with regard to their form of dress, like fabric, colors, jewels, and that sort of thing. But how do we go from those instructions and descriptions to the modern-day things we see in Catholic churches today? I know that there can be different architectural types, like traditional, modern, and stuff, but there are things that you see in all churches, like the colors, fabrics worn by the priests, the positioning of the altar, stations of the cross being displayed. All the shapes and colors have a meaning and a detail. So I wanted to know, where do we get those from?
Okay. Well, it's true that God did prescribe for the people of Israel that their priests wear a certain kind of dress and that they design their worship space, which initially was called the tabernacle and later the temple when they made it a permanent structure. He did give instructions for how those were to be made. And as God's people before the time of Christ, that's what they needed to do. But when Christ came, he, as St. Paul says, was the end of the Jewish law. And so as a result, Christians did not feel bound to imitate those things. And in fact, Christians initially being a small minority that principally came from the poor and the middle class, they didn't have a lot of money. And so they couldn't have afforded to build, you know, magnificent buildings or have fancy clothing for their priests. And so they looked a lot, they originally met in just ordinary houses. And they dressed the way people ordinarily dressed in their cultures, whether they were Jewish or Greek or Roman or whatever they may have been. And then over the course of time, as Christians became larger as a group and they had more resources available, then they could afford to upgrade the worship spaces they were using. So they started building actual church buildings, and they started improving the quality of the clothing that priests could wear and things like that. And it grew organically over time. And different things have different origins. The Stations of the Cross you mentioned, for example, are something that came in the late Middle Ages, because what happened was people would go on in the high Middle Ages, they'd go on crusades over to Jerusalem, and they would walk the way of the cross in Jerusalem with the actual sites, you know, or where it was commemorated. Okay, Jesus fell here, and this is where Jesus was crucified, and they saw those sites. And then they came back from the Crusades, and to help other people share in that experience, they made Stations of the Cross, so that even if you couldn't go to Jerusalem and walk the actual way of the cross, you could walk the Stations of the Cross and kind of spiritually participate in that journey. And there's a rich history of how different things came to be part of Christian worship, whether it's clothing or symbols in church or things like that. There's no concise way to say we got them all from here, because they developed over the course of time, and culture just grows organically over time. And that's what happened with Christian worship culture. There are some books that you might want to check out for more information. There are various dictionaries of the liturgy that you could find that would give you history of particular garments that a priest would wear. Also, there's a book or two-volume book called Mass of the Modern Roman Rite, or Mass of the Roman Rite, by a scholar named Joseph Jungmann, J-U-N-G-M-A-N, and there may be two N's on the end of it, but Mass of the Roman Rite by Joseph Jungmann. And there are also histories of other Catholic rites of Mass, but if you want to track down the origin of a particular symbol, it's technical resource works like that or dictionaries of the liturgy that you would want to consult.
Chris, thank you very, very much. I'm going to keep moving. We'll go to Shannon in Kansas, watching on YouTube. Shannon, go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. My question has to deal with, I guess, so I see a chiropractor, and he uses muscle testing, I guess also known as like applied kinesiology. And to kind of get at like the root of maybe some like emotional problems that is causing physical pain. And I was wondering if that was okay or not with the Catholic Church.
Okay.
And well, I guess I should add that he is Catholic, this doctor. I don't know. That's my question.
So is he trying to lay anything spiritual or religious over this practice, or is he just saying, I'm going to test your muscles and that may let me know something about your psychology?
Yeah, the second thing that you said.
The second. Okay. So he's not trying to attribute any religious significance to this act. He's discussing it purely in terms of science, like kinesiology, which has to do with motion in your muscles, and psychology. Now, that means that there's nothing in principle that's wrong about this. He's not importing any non-Christian ideas of a religious nature into this. And so the church would look at this like any other proposed therapy and say, well, it checks out on the religious front because no false religion is being introduced here, but it still got to pass muster on the scientific front. Does reason actually support the claims of this form of therapy? And there's a dispute about this. Chiropractic medicine itself is something there's a dispute about. Both chiropractic and applied kinesiology are considered alternative medicines, so they haven't been accepted by mainstream traditional medicine. That doesn't mean they're automatically useless, but it also doesn't mean that they've been proved to be useful to the satisfaction of most doctors. So I would say if you get benefit from this, then it's fine to go ahead and use it. But if you find you're not getting any benefit from this, then don't use it. In terms of if you do get benefit, why would that benefit happen? Well, it could happen because there is some way to deduce people's psychological state by testing their muscles. On the other hand, there may not be a way to deduce someone's psychological state by testing their muscles, but it may be the placebo effect. You know, the mere fact you're going through this procedure could give you comfort and allow you to heal yourself, in essence. That's what the placebo effect is. So if it has a benefit, then it could be used. If it doesn't have a benefit, then I would say don't waste my money on it. One thing I would do is be careful about attributing too much significance to it. It's not obvious how one could deduce a psychological state from muscles other than, wow, your muscles are really tense. You must be emotionally tense. But, you know, you could kind of deduce that from someone's muscles maybe. But if it's like your muscles are responding this way and that means you must have been abused as a child, well, that's a completely different claim. So I would say be cautious, but those are the principles I would apply.
Thanks very much. Appreciate the call. Shannon, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin, 888-318-7884.
Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers is doing it again. We're holding our 7th annual Apologetics Conference this September in beautiful San Diego, California, and we'd like to see you there. Join us September 23rd to 26th for a lively and inspiring conference with an all-star lineup of speakers guaranteed to jumpstart your faith. It's a great chance to meet all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists and very special guests as we spend 4 days talking about worshiping and adoring our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. This is where it all begins. Don't miss what promises to be the event of the season. Join us this September for a conference that is sure to ignite, inspire, and inform your faith. Seats are still available, but they're going fast. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com or call 888-291-8000 to register.
Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Hi, this is Janet Williams. You don't have to be a woman to enjoy Women of Grace tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
I dig it. A little bit of groovy music. Thanks, Darren. All right, feeling groovy. Jimmy Akin here. Thursday, Open Forum, all good. You can call with any question you want, 888-318-7884. Up next is Zelly in Michigan. listening on Catholic.com. Zelly, are you there with us?
Yes, I am. I wanted to say thank you so much for taking my call. My question is, how can we believe that the Eucharist is truly Christ's body if a body is inherently physical? I want to just further specify, like, what exactly I'm looking for is that the only part of us that isn't physical is our spirit, but we don't say that Christ is only spiritually present. So how do we reconcile that?
All right.
So the fact that the difficulty here has to do with the word physical. It means different things, and it's true that our bodies are physical, but I'm trying to avoid a discussion of Greek, but I'm not sure I'm going to be able to avoid it. So let me just go ahead and do it. The Greek word for physical, phusis, means natural. So something is physical if it's natural. And Christ's natural body is present in the Eucharist. But in ordinary life, see a lot of cases where a natural body or a physical body is present in more than one place at a time. However, there's nothing in principle that would stop God from taking a natural body or a physical body and making it present in two places or three places or as many places as God chooses. How can we understand that? Well, a principle that I often use in thinking about miracles is if I can think of a way that the effect of a miracle could be accomplished, then God knows at least that way. He probably knows all kinds of other ways, including ones I can't even imagine. But if I can think of at least one way it could happen, that shows that this miracle is possible, and thus God knows how to do it. In the case of how could a natural body or a physical object be present in more than one place at a time, we have a special advantage in that we're living in the 21st century. Because about 100 years ago, Albert Einstein figured out that the way people were understanding space and time was not fully correct. People had always assumed that space and time are absolutes, that space is just the way it is. You can't fold it or bend it or distort it or anything like that. And similarly, time is just the way time is. It always progresses at the same rate. It never gets faster or slower or anything like that. And what Einstein was able to show is that actually space and time can be bent. They can take other shapes besides the ones that we naturally think of. And so, as a result, it's possible for space to be bent in such a way that a single physical object could be in more than one place. If you want a way to think about that, imagine taking a piece of paper, which will represent space, and then maybe put a drop of food color on one side of one of the top of the paper, and then fold the paper together so that that drop of food color is now in two places at once. It's in one part of the sheet, but because you folded the sheet, it's also at another part of the sheet where the two sides make contact with each other. And then if you unfold the piece of paper, you'll see, yeah, I've got food color in both of these places. Well, since you can fold a piece of paper so that a single drop of food color is in more than one place on the paper when you folded it together, God can fold space in a way that makes a single physical body, like that drop of food color or Jesus's body or anything else, present in more than one place. And he could do even more complex folding that would allow a single physical object to be in even more places than that. So if I can think of how we can accomplish the effect of this miracle just using Albert Einstein's insights, then God knows at least that way of doing it, and probably lots of other ways. I don't know which way God is doing it, but if God tells me this is what I'm doing, I'm making this natural physical body appear in more than one place at a time, then I can believe God that that's what he's doing, even if I don't know which particular means he's using to cause that to happen.
Okay, Zelly?
I think so. I think that helped a lot. Thanks.
Okay. All right. Very, very good. Thank you for the call. I'm going to go to Kyle in, we got a lot of calls from here lately. Going to Kyle in New York City. New York City! Watching on YouTube. Go ahead, Kyle.
Hi, gentlemen. Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Very well. Thank you.
All right, perfect. I'm going to try to make this quick and concise. I was talking with one of my dear friends who lives in Latin America, in the country of Colombia, and he is married and has a child with his wife, but they have a bit of an abnormal situation. Both are practicing very faithful Catholics, and they planned to do their wedding in the church, but the pandemic hit, of course, and the government of Colombia actually closed not only everything, but including churches for the good part of a year. It was pretty controversial. So what they said was anybody who needs to get married, in their case that they did because the wife was from a different country in Latin America and they had a child, they could do so in a notary so they could get the visa and stay together as a family. My question is, in this particular case, they're now planning their wedding in the church. They're getting everything squared away. During this time and up until now, could they still receive the sacraments and or confession, or is that not a possibility considering that they're, you know, acting as a family, not being married in the church? The reason I ask this is because we were talking about this together, and it seemed to me that this was a bit of an extenuating circumstance. It wasn't as if they were just flippantly choosing not to get married in the church. So I wasn't sure if that mitigated a bit of the circumstances.
All right, Jimmy?
Okay. So the reason that Catholics need to get married in the church is because church law requires Catholics to either get married in the church or get a dispensation to have a non-Catholic marriage or be in special circumstances. And it's kind of like the church is kind of like a state in this regard. If you're a member of a particular country, you need to observe that country's marriage laws. So if you're a member of the church, you need to observe the church's marriage laws. But the church's marriage laws include an exception for when people cannot approach a priest or a deacon or otherwise take care of the formalities needed in order to have a church wedding. And in canon law, the standard interpretation of that is actually if it's not possible for 30 days, you could have a marriage that's non-Catholic. And so given the pandemic situation, if they got married after their country closed all the churches and stopped them from being able to get married in the church, then if that condition was going to go on for an extended period of time, which obviously it was, then canon law itself would allow them to approach a notary and be married that way. So based on the fact pattern you described, I would assume that they are validly married. If they want to go on and have a wedding in the church too, that's great. That's a great thing to do. But they would already be validly married. And so as a result, the fact they're living as husband and wife would not prevent them from going to confession or receiving the Eucharist or participating in the other sacraments, because they're validly married husband and wife, at least based on the fact pattern you've described.
Wow, that one worked out pretty good, huh, Kyle?
Yeah, may I ask a very quick follow-up, or do we not have time for that?
For a very quick one, we do.
Yeah, for that dispensation you mentioned, does there need to be anything formal about that, or is it just recognized as the situation they have the dispensation automatically?
It's not a dispensation. It's just the way the law is written. Catholics are not required to observe the Catholic form of marriage when it's not possible to obtain a Catholic marriage for an extended period. And that's described in the Code of Canon Law itself. So if you want more information about that, or if you want to look up the text so you can provide it to your friend, the Code of Canon Law is on the Vatican website. I would Google Vatican.va, that's the Vatican website, and Code of Canon Law, it'll come up. And then you want to look in the section under matrimony on the form of matrimony.
Thanks, Kyle. Thanks very much. We got to go to a break. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Open Forum. Have you heard about the great new Catholic Answers Rewards program? It's our new program at shop.catholic.com, where pretty much everything you do earns you points, and you can cash them in for great Catholic resources. You get points every time you shop, when you sign up for an account, do a review, refer a friend. There's 10 different ways to earn points, and it's so easy. Just visit shop.catholic.com/rewards today and get started. That's shop.catholic.com/rewards.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
He is only one of four popes honored as the great.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Leo I was pope at a time when Roman civilization was being overrun by barbarian armies. He stood as a light in the darkness and even saved the city of Rome from destruction by Attila and the Huns. Leo died in 461.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Open Forum. Jimmy Akin, our guest, just across the border from us in Mexicali, Mexico. Francisco, listening on 95.7 FM. Francisco, thank you very much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. Congratulations for the show.
Thank you.
What is more important, the civil marriage or church marriage?
Well, it depends on what you want to accomplish by having a civil marriage or a church marriage. If you want to have, you know, the right to inherit from your spouse when they die, well, then you need a civil marriage for that. And if your church doesn't, if your state does not recognize church marriages, well, then yeah, a civil marriage would be more important than a church marriage for purposes of inheritance rights. But if you want the right to engage in sexual intercourse with your spouse, you need a church marriage if you're a Catholic, or it needs to be a special circumstance where you're not required to have a church marriage, because you need to be validly married with your spouse in God's eyes. And if you're a Catholic, under most circumstances, you need to have a Catholic wedding in order to be validly married in God's eyes. And from the broader perspective, if we think about the fact that marriage between two Christians is a sacrament and that God gives us his grace through that sacrament, and those graces will help us not only live as spouses in this life, but also help us get to heaven, then in terms of the benefits you're going to get from having a church marriage, they well exceed the value of a civil marriage that only has to do with the things of this life. So It's going to depend on the purpose, but fundamentally, you want to be right with God. And if you're a Catholic, that means most of the time you're going to need to be having a church marriage.
I see. Is a civil marriage valid in God's sight?
Not if you're a Catholic under most circumstances. If you're a citizen of the Catholic Church, you need to obey the Catholic Church's marriage laws. And most of the time, that means that you need to have a Catholic marriage. If you say, I don't care, I'm going to get married outside the church, even though I don't have a good reason, well, then it's not going to be valid. You will not be married in God's eyes. You'll be two people sleeping together.
Great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Francisco.
No problem.
Thanks very, very much.
By the way, I wanted to add, I was able to look up the specific canon I wanted to refer our previous caller to, which was also on the subject of marriage. It's Canon 1116. Canon 1116, and it provides that it is possible for a Catholic to be able to enter into a marriage contract without observing the Catholic form if it can't be done without grave inconvenience, like when the state says all of your churches are closed, all your base are belong to us, and the situation will continue for a month.
Yeah, okay.
So Canon 1116.
All right. Jimmy Akin, our guest. It's open forum. Let's see who we got next here. Where am I going? We got Lee in Colorado listening to EWTN on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Channel 130. Lee, thank you very much for the call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Yes, I did have a question, but...
Good. That's what we're here for.
I wanted to comment, though, if you would allow me. The young lady who had gone to the chiropractor for working emotional work or whatever it was, I am a Catholic and a practicing chiropractor of 37 years, and I would perhaps just like to clear up some things about these types
of treatments. Okay, Lee, actually, we're getting close to the end of the show, and I tried to give as neutral and balanced an answer as I could without taking sides on that issue. If we're getting into details that have to do with is this practice efficacious or not efficacious, you know, what's the evidence for the medical benefit of a particular therapy, that's really getting us beyond what the subject matter of this show is. So I tried to answer in as neutral a way as I can, but if we open it up to comments from people of different perspectives, and one person says, well, I think the scientific evidence is this, and I think the medical evidence is this, then we're going to have to let other people come on and say, well, I think it's this, and I think it's this other thing.
And
it's not really a medical debate show.
Probably would find my original question more intriguing.
All right, let's intrigue him. Go ahead.
Yes. Okay. God, who created the heavens and the earth and us, knowing all things from beyond time, I wonder, why did God create the world, the heavens and the earth, and mankind, knowing that things would turn out as they've turned out, how man has just become a scourge of the universe? Why would he have created us, but knowing all this is going to happen?
Okay, I would have a somewhat more positive evaluation of man. I don't think man is a scourge of the universe. I think that humans are flawed, but fundamentally we're created in the image of God, and even though that image has been disfigured by sin, human beings are still good. They're still valuable. Jesus himself, for example, says that we're worth many sparrows or a multitude of sparrows, where we have intrinsic value that comes to us from God. And so I'd have a more positive view of humanity, at least in terms of how I'd express it. In terms of why would God create the world knowing that it's going to involve things like sin and suffering, this is a rich question. In fact, I gave a talk a few years ago called The Problem of Evil, which deals exactly with this question. And Cy, since Lee is here in the United States, maybe we can send him a copy of my talk, The Problem of Evil, because it'll go into more detail than I can. Here, the fundamental reason is, as the Catechism states, God would not allow any evil, either physical evil like pain or moral evil like sin. He would not allow any evil unless he had a way to bring a good out of it. And so the fact that God will ultimately bring about a greater good as a result of allowing these evils is something that makes them livable. You know, if I come to you as a chiropractor, I'm having back pain and you're going to do an adjustment on me, maybe that adjustment's going to hurt a little bit in the moment you do it. And I know they do because I've gone to chiropractors, but that doesn't stop me from going to chiropractors because I know the good that's going to come out of that. Even if I have this little momentary pain, there's a greater good that's going to come out of it. And I'm willing to have the momentary pain in order to have the greater good of having my back back in alignment so that I'm not constantly hurting from that. And in the same way, it's rational for us as humans to look at the situation of the world and say, yes, there's sin, yes, there's suffering, but I can put up with those, I can tolerate those, as long as God will ultimately bring about a greater good.
Lee, I'm going to try to get as many as I can on before we have to go, so thank you very, very much for the call and for your understanding. We're going to go to Ryan in Boston, Massachusetts, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Go ahead, Ryan, with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, guys. How you doing? So I just want to know, on the Church Fathers, I just want a general, deeper understanding of my Catholic faith and what would be a good starting point. I've read the Ignatius letters and the first part, the part one of the Catechism. I'm just looking for more.
Okay. I would suggest a book that I happen to write called The Fathers Know Best. It's organized by topic, so you can look at what the Church Fathers had to say on particular topics like baptism or the Eucharist or other aspects of the Catholic faith. And it's also organized chronologically. So you start with the earliest references and then you move through history and see how their teaching progressed on that particular topic. So it covers like 50 topics. So I would recommend The Fathers Know Best. It also has introductions to the individual fathers, who they were, when they lived, where they lived, what was going on in their time, that kind of stuff.
Ryan, you can get it at shop.catholic.com or I can send it to you free. What would you prefer?
I'll buy it. What? For you guys. Don't worry.
I wasn't expecting
awesome.
That.
Thank you, Ryan.
All right. Oh, also, are you interested in the Brooklyn Bridge? No, I'm just kidding, Ryan. Thank you. That's very nice of you to support us that way. Let's go to, I'm going to try to get everybody on if I can. Caleb in Lincoln, Nebraska, listening on Spirit Catholic Radio. You are up next, Caleb. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you, Jimmy. My understanding is that the Catholic Church does not endorse supersessionism. So my question is, or what I'm having trouble understanding, is how can adherents of Catholicism and Judaism both be considered people of God without that undercutting the Catholic Church in its role as the avenue of salvation?
Could you repeat the question? I wanted to make sure I caught all of it.
Yeah. So my understanding is the Catholic Church does not endorse supersessionism. So
correct.
With that knowledge, I am having trouble understanding how both adherents of Catholicism and Judaism can both be considered God's people without that undercutting the Catholic Church as its role in as the
okay.
avenue of salvation. Like,
so what it means to be God's people can mean more than one thing. What it means to be God's people in a fundamental sense means God has a special relationship with you. But that special relationship does not mean you're automatically going to be saved in the eternal sense. You're not automatically going to end up going to heaven. And so it's possible both for Jews and Gentiles to have a special relationship with God without that meaning that they're automatically going to go to heaven. So Jewish people need to, ordinarily, they need to believe in their Messiah, in Jesus of Nazareth, and receive salvation through him. God has ways of sharing salvation through Jesus with non-Christians, even, if they're innocently ignorant of this. But ordinarily, you know, someone needs to have faith in Jesus. That doesn't mean that Jewish people don't have a special relationship with God on the basis of the covenants he made with their forefathers. They do, but that doesn't mean they're automatically saved if they were to knowingly and deliberately reject Jesus. In the same way, if someone was a Catholic and then turned their back on Jesus, well, they still have a relationship with God, but it's not a saving relationship if they're knowingly and deliberately rejecting Jesus. So basic answer, being one of God's people, whether you're a Jew or a Gentile, does mean you have a special relationship with God, but it doesn't mean you will be going to heaven if you consciously, knowingly, and deliberately reject Jesus in favor of a life of living apart from God.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much, Caleb. Appreciate it. Jimmy Akin, our guest. Jimmy, also the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Tomorrow, it will be the part two of the September 11th, 2001 kind of retrospective. And this includes some audio that many people may not have heard.
No, that was the first part.
Oh, the first part
includes
the audio.
The second part, we're focusing on the conspiracy.
Okay. So if you haven't heard the first part, you can do that. The second part, the conspiracy. You're comfortable with that word conspiracy. This really was a conspiracy.
Absolutely. It involved two or more people agreeing to do something illegal. So by definition, it was a conspiracy.
You can catch Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World every Friday morning. Type in Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. 70,000 other people every week are checking it out. You should be too. Jimmy, thanks very, very much. Appreciate the hour.
My pleasure. Likewise.
And what are we? We've got Joe Heschmeyer tomorrow. Okay, so Joe's still in town. You may know this. Our colleague Joe Heschmeyer in town this week, so he'll be on with us 2 hours tomorrow. We'll see you then, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.
This is Kevin O'Brien of EWTN's Theater of the Word. I'm excited also to teach middle school and high school literature, speech, and drama with homeschoolconnections.com, an online Catholic curriculum provider. Your student can meet with me online for a live, interactive class. Whether you take apologetics with John Martinoni, or grade school with Jackie De La Viaga, or any of the other 400-plus courses with homeschoolconnections.com, online Catholic learning for your homeschooling family is available for you.